You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 232 is Jorma Kaukonen, best known as the lead guitarist for Jefferson Airplane for their seven albums released between 1966 and 1972. You're right now hearing his song Embryonic Journey that was put on their second album, The Most Famous Surrealistic Pillow, 1967. Jefferson Airplane through a lot of that time also featured Jorma's very old friend Jack Cassidy on bass, and the two of them formed Hot Tuna during the latter days of Jefferson Airplane, releasing two albums in the early 70s and then six more. After the two left Jefferson Airplane through 1976, Jorma had released his first solo album, Qua, in 1974, but then took up his solo career in earnest with the dissolution of Hot Tuna, releasing 10 albums from 1981 through 2015. And there was a Jefferson Airplane reunion album in 1989. There was a Hot Tuna reunion album in 1990, and then another one in 2011. Jorma currently works out of a ranch in Ohio. He's a music educator. He plays a lot of solo gigs and gigs as Hot Tuna, both acoustic and sometimes electric. He often plays out with his old friend John Hurlbut, and they've recorded three albums as a duo in very recent years. So this brings his total number of studio releases up to somewhere around 32, plus many more live releases and some collaborations with folks from the Grateful Dead. There was a recent archive release of recordings he had made in the 60s with Janis Joplin. You could get all this chronology straight by taking a look at Been So Long, My Life and Music, his 2018 autobiography. Today we're going to talk about In My Dreams from his last solo album, 2015's Ain't In No Hurry. Then we'll look to a new recording from River of Time 2009 of his song Been So Long, which is actually a very old song, first released in 1971 on Hot Tuna's live release, First Pull Up, Then Pull Down. We are then going to discuss one of those 70s recordings for Sleep Song by Hot Tuna from America's Choice, 1975. And we'll conclude by introducing Jorma's 1960 performance of Hesitation Blues. That's a W.C. Handy tune that he learned about through the work of Reverend Gary Davis, who is no doubt Jorma's biggest influence, and it's just been released on Reno Road, unreleased tracks from the 60s. For more information, please see jormakaukonen.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to get your episodes ad-free with my episode notes, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will play a little of Embryonic Journey, released on the Jefferson Airplane album Surrealistic Pillow, 1967. Do you know when that was actually written? A couple of years before that, or just...
I was still in college when I wrote that song, and I'm guessing it was probably 63 or 64.
Okay.
Definitely in that time period, yeah. It was an accident. There was this little coffee house, was the kind of place that we all played back in those days, on First Avenue in San Jose, called the Folk Theater. There was a folk duo, Roger Perkins and Larry Hanks, had played there. Roger was playing in a drop D tuning. We'll geek out a little bit for the guitar players who are out there. And everybody knows the drop D tuning. You take the low E string, just tune it down to a D, and it's a very rich sounding thing. In any case, it was a new world for me. I was very excited about this. And I remember I was doing some sort of a workshop at the University of Santa Clara, and I put it in drop D, and I was just picking and messing around with stuff. And honestly, one thing led to another. So I love when people say, well, when you wrote that song, it seemed, you know, that sounds like you're approaching a composition and sitting down with the sheet music in front of you. The simple answer is the guitar almost always tells me what to do. And on that day, it told me to do that. And the good news is that my college roommate at that time, Peter Manchester, he recorded everything I did, and he recorded it at the end of the day. He said, you know, that's almost a song. You should think about it. And I did.
And that it appeared on the Airplane album just because it was still with you jamming, you know, not that you even put it forward and said, I want this to represent me.
No. In fact, Rick Gerard was the guy that produced the Airplane album. We were pretty much finished with the album. And remember, I was sitting out in the reception and just talking to one of the guards and playing my acoustic guitar. And Rick came out and heard I was playing. Maybe I played, probably playing that song. He says, come on in, we should record that. And I remember at the time, I thought it was the worst idea for a rock album that I'd ever heard. obviously, in retrospect, it was a stroke of genius.
Yes, and later became sort of a standard thing with the prog bands of having, oh, let's have Steve Howe, Steve Hackett, whatever, do a little, show off their guitar acoustic licks just to give a little break. But this was probably the first time that was done.
Probably.
Well, we want to get pretty quickly to the newer stuff. You're still writing many, many albums later. In My Dreams is the one that I was drawn to from your latest album of originals. Well, you know, that has originals on it, Ain't No Hurry 2014, which, of course, you've done some albums since then. But I think this is sort of in line with what you were just saying about Embryonic Journey, that you've described your relationship to composition as, okay, there's songwriting, and I occasionally do that when I have something that I want to say or, you know, something, but that the guitar just writes things so that when you're doing, you know, you could be doing, so covers, you know, traditional songs by other people in the band take up just as much of your mental space because it's still exactly the same creative thing that you're doing as fundamentally.
So I'm not a prolific songwriter, but because I've been in the game for a long time over the years, I've wound up writing a lot of songs. And I think that only once did I actually set out to write a song where I wrote lyrics first and then later on put music, and that was River of Time. On the River of Time album. But like In My Dreams, for example, I remember I was just laying around, I was on the road, and this word popped up into my waking mind, and it was, you never seem to age in my dream. And for some reason, the light went off, and I got up and I grabbed my guitar. It's a C-shaped song for guitar players, and I just started messing around with it. And again, one thing led to the other. And the thing that made it work was I didn't go back to sleep. I stayed awake until I finished it, because if I'd gone back to sleep, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, can you say a little, more where you're at in terms of your overall songwriting development and things just before we hear it briefly, and then we'll talk about it in detail.
There's a Reverend Gary Davis song called I'm the Light of This World, and he has this one move where he's playing an F chord. This is geeky guitar stuff, but playing an F chord, and where he, or me, if I'm playing one of those songs, we'd be playing the first fret of the sixth string with my thumb, and then releasing that so it's an open E string, which now makes it an F major seventh with the major seventh at the bottom. It's a pretty sound. It's a pretty move, regardless of how you talk about it. It's one of those things I've been playing, like I'm the Light of This World, for a lifetime. And I was just playing this, messing around with it, picking in the key of C. My thumb came with, I did that F, open up that sixth string again. All of a sudden, it all started to make sense, and one thing led to another. I mean, I wish there was more conscious methodology to it, but my methodology is always where if one is lucky enough to get an inspiration about something, you need to be like a dog on a bone about it immediately, you know? And that's what I did, because I also had that line, you never seem to age in my dream. And I just sat down, and an hour later, I had the song. Now, it doesn't always happen like that, but it did on that morning.
With me, we'll go running through the mountains just to time set the morning free. Our hearts are young and strong, you're moving like an angel. We never seem to age in my dream. I never took my time, I took it all for granted. The gift of life is never what it seems. Let's run like we did then, like spirits in the morning. We never seem to age in my dream. These precious moments fly like pages in the wind, flying to a place beyond the stars. The memories fade with grace, like rust, and leave us wondering who and what we are. Thank you. That sunrise shone like gold. I thought I'd live forever, but living well was way beyond my means. This moment breathes like fire. We watched the dawn together. We never seemed to age in my dream. This morning as I woke, as the midnight spell was broken, I looked around with nothing left to need. The world around us turns. I hold each passing moment. We never seem to age in my dream. We never seem to age in my dream. You never seem to age in my dream.
Pretty minimal arrangement. So this is the Acoustic Hot Tuna lineup, right? This is Jack Cassidy and Barry Mindenhoff.
Right. So I remember Larry Campbell was the producer of that record. And, you know, Larry, to his credit, realized that that song was pretty much complete in and of itself and did not need a lot of instrumentation. And so when we got ready to record it, because he just said, you know, let's keep it simple, you know, play it with Barry. And that was it. And that's what happened. Now, Jack and I play the song together all the time. I can't imagine this would happen. But if for some reason we were to re-record this on a studio album, I would want to do it live with him rather than bricklaying like the way producers like you to do it these days.
He's still playing electric, right? So it's not a matter of bleed across tracks or something.
Well, so actually, if I was going to do that song with Jack, I would probably do it acoustically also. That's a good question. And the answer is, until you're faced with those decisions and you can get some sonic samples, it's hard to say what you would do. You know, just talking to you here about it today and not being in a studio messing around, I would probably still want to do it with an acoustic guitar as a basic track. But that being said, you know, to get a really good sound on an acoustic guitar, that takes up a lot of sonic room.
Mm-hmm.
If one was doing an electric production, it might be better to do it with an electric guitar with heavy strings, not with like rock and roll strings, but with heavy strings.
I was trying to figure out, so in the solo section, I mean, that's the only part that the mandolin has to be in. Otherwise, it's just a little bit of sweetening here and there. It's not.
It's like little filigrees and stuff like that, yeah.
When the B section comes again, then you switch to a guitar solo, but are you actually deviating from what you would normally play, or you're just, it's coming out because the mandolin has gone away?
So in that song, the so-called instrumental section, it's really not much different from the accompanying to the lyrics. And I remember when I was working it out, you know, every now and then it's like it seems incumbent upon an acoustic guitar player to come up with some mind-bending solo or something like that, and I just didn't see that was necessary. So it's similar, but it's inflected a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of thinking about it as something where I'm accompanying a vocal, I want to work the tonalities of the guitar using those chord shapes.
Well, and it seems that is what keeps, I don't know, if you do it now, do you inflect it the same way pretty much every time? Or is it constantly? I mean, it doesn't seem it's an accident that there's so many of your live shows. Like if people go to your Spotify channel or the Hot Tuna Spotify, it's really hard to find the actual albums because there's so many of these live recordings, which presumably are all slightly different. Can you say a little about just sort of how you're continuing to feel out these songs such that it would be worth, instead of just like, oh, find the best live one?
Hey, that's funny.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's a real answer to that. You know, I mean, the good news is that for a guy like me who plays out a lot, there's a lot of versions out there. But I know if I'm going down somebody's rabbit hole, I want to see what they're going on. It's like, God, there's so many of these things. Where am I going to start? So I'm of the opinion, for the most part, that live music is always best. And so if it's an artist that I like and I know he or she does a good live show and I want to listen to one of their songs, I'm going to go to a live version. If you think about, you know, when I wrote that song, we recorded it, that's early in the genesis of the performance of that song. Now, it hasn't mutated a lot. It's the same song. I mean, if you're thinking about playing a song, it's telling a story. And the story is being told by the instrumental arrangement as well as the lyrics, it's going to be a little bit different. So I think when I go to do the solo, and I'm using the term solo loosely because it's very similar to the same thing, I dig in a little more. I'm trying to get a little more sonic texture out of it than I would when I'm accompanying myself. I don't think I think about it like this when I play, but when I listen to it, I hear, yeah, that's what I'm doing. If I'm accompanying myself, I don't want to take away from the lyrics, or I'm not going to do stuff that's going to upset the lyrical apple cart, if that makes any sense.
Now, you mentioned, layering on the other instruments. Do you still insist, though, like with this recording, I'm going to do my guitar and vocal together because they're one organic, or does the engineer, oh, please, please, let me just get the acoustic in a nice thing, or lay down a guide and then play against yourself and sing against, or, you know.
Yeah, well, producers tend to like to do that because it makes the work go quicker. Mm-hmm. But with a song like this for me, because I remember, it's been a while since I recorded, but I'm sure we'll lay a basic and then we'll do the vocal. It's never the same. It's never the same. I'm not saying it's better or worse. It's just different. But as somebody that sings songs while he plays them, if I'm playing a song without singing, it's going to be different. Now, the question, is it better or worse? I guess the answer is for a listener other than myself. But for myself, the voice is like a third hand. It's part of the whole thing. And so to have overdub it, a song like that, I think is a good thing. For example, on the Qua album, the Genesis, absolutely played and sung at the same time. Actually, all that record, all played and sung at the same time. But there's not a lot of overdub, so it's easy to do.
Sure. So, I mean, would that generally mean we're recording more takes, or it doesn't really matter that you've already practiced these up?
I think early takes tend to be better.
Maybe take two. Maybe take one is going to be a little... Or maybe for you, take one is flawless.
I mean, like Embryonic Journey on, I believe that was a second take on the Cirrus the Pillow album. Because with a song like that, it's like you kind of shoot your wad and it's good. And now, how am I ever going to get there again? I mean, that's the kind of stuff we go into psychoanalysis about. But yeah, I mean, I think if you can get a good early take, it's going to have fire that the later takes, even though they might be more quote unquote perfect, they may or may not have the same fire.
Let's talk about the lyrics of this one. So frolicking in the forest. I know you're very into that. This is not just song imagery, but going fast, speed skating, motorcycle, traveling of any sort seems to be an obsession. I don't know. Any thoughts about, do you generally spill the lyrics out in one go? Are you going back and picking at things?
So I'm not sure this is the best way to write a song, but what usually works for me is some sort of an inspiration, which would probably start with a guitar thing, whatever that thing might be, depending on the song, and maybe capturing one or two lines that fit into whatever thing is beginning to evolve on the guitar. And then to just put myself in that universe and stay there until the song is done. I don't write more than one song at a sitting, but most of the songs I've written have been pretty much completed in a sitting. That's not to say, you might not like look at some syntax or something like that, but for the most part, like Genesis, for example, and I wish I could write a song like that all the time, but it doesn't work like that. But I had those lyrics, and the lyrics came out, and boom, the song was done. I remember I wrote it probably in less than an hour.
Well, and you've got a nice mix in this song of just dream imagery of the frolicking, but then now we're wistful. We're actually still in the verse. It's not like you only switch to this when you hit the B section, but the taking it all for granted, gift of life is never what it seems, which that idea of taking for granted, this, if I'm obsessed by this, this is just because I discovered your autobiography 2 days ago and I completely binged it. And so you've been talking in my head constantly at double speed for quite a long time. And this seems to be sort of the redemption story, as Jack describes it in the outro of the book, is, that... Yes, no longer taking life for granted or taking other people's presence for granted or this kind of stuff. Yes. Thoughts on how that relates to this song?
All my writing has always been in the moment stuff. I probably couldn't have written that book in that way today. I would have written another book, but it wouldn't have been like that. I'm a lucky guy. I mean, that life has its ups and downs like everybody does, but I'm still here. Knock on wood, I haven't had any horrible diseases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And for many years, you'd go along. Yeah. And you kind of take for granted you're going to get up and it might not be a great day, but it's going to be a day. And after a while, you realize that every day is not a given that you're going to get through that day. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I obsess on the fact that I could get hit by a car after we have this conversation. But I think that I've really become consciously much more grateful and appreciative of the gifts of life that we're all given. But most of the time, I don't think about them, you know, not in the past. At this point in my life, I think about them all the time. I mean, like I joke, I've got a son that's almost 30 years old, a daughter that's in college. I haven't had to bail either one of them out of jail, you know? I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, wow, that's not always the case. It's, life is good.
So in the third verse, sunrise shone like gold, thought I'd live forever, but living well was way beyond my means. So that's another thing from the book, which it seems like that's a kind of a downer statement to put in this very breezy particular part of the song.
I don't really see that as a downer. I think it's a way station along the road. And I suspect, I don't know, you can't write scripts for other people's lives, but I imagine that everybody has ups and downs in life. And sometimes I just can't imagine that anybody would have a life where at some moment things didn't spiral out of control, at least for 5 minutes. And with that in mind, living well is way beyond my means. I mean, I guess you just think about, you know, you take the stuff for granted. You end up do a bunch of stupid shit. And if you're lucky enough, you get to come out on the other end of it all and reflect on it and pay homage to it in some sort of a way without being too self-conscious.
In the last verse, I looked around with nothing left to need. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, nothing left to need. Yeah. It's like, you know, you think about in a materialistic kind of way, it's like, what do I need? Do I need a new car today? Do you need a lot of stuff? I mean, over the course of our lives, I guess we, or certainly myself, have convinced myself that you need a lot of stuff in order to be whoever you are. And at some point, I think I realized that, you know, I'm okay if for some reason something happened and I lost a lot of the material detritus that I've collected over the years. I've got a subtext about that in a minute, too. I'm going to be okay. And the subtext is, when my parents passed away in the 90s, my parents never threw anything away. They left all this crap to my brother. And there were pictures of them. My grandparents were born in the 1880s. That was a long time ago. And so all these pictures, we had, of course, they took pictures and pictures of the family over the years, blah, blah, blah. If you look pictures of my family from the late 1800s or the early 1900s, everybody in these pictures looks exactly the same. I mean, the men and the women are all dressed in black. They all look pissed off. I mean, that's just the deal. It could be your family from that time. Anyway, my parents never threw all these stuff away, passed away, left it to my brother. My brother wisely, about a decade or so ago, packed all this shit up and sent it to me and Vanessa. And there it lived in my garage for another 10 years or so, until earlier this year, where I got a 30-foot dumpster and I went through this stuff and just threw it. It's something that didn't actually mean something to me, you know. We just threw all the shit away. And it was incredibly cathartic in a really good kind of way.
The amount of space in your autobiography spent on your grandparents, on your, you know, clearly history means something to you.
Sure.
But if it's not something that you can actually absorb.
Right.
Like one picture, three pictures.
Yes. I mean, it meant a lot to me because when I was growing up, my grandparents spent a lot of time raising us. When I was born in 1940, so my father was gone during World War II, et cetera, et cetera. So my mom and I lived with my grandparents a lot. So they were really a part of my growing up life. And the other thing, too, was the fact that English was not their first language, that they were immigrants that came over here and did a damn good job establishing themselves in this country. In a way, that created a universe that was sort of like distant and parallel in a way to the universe that I lived in the little neighborhood, where most of the families that were there were not of immigrant families. But it was cool, you know? I mean, that's how it was. I mean, I didn't think about it a lot, except to realize that in some ways, we were different from Mr. Floogie next door.
We're going to stop for some sponsor messages. Movie lovers, I've got a fantastic podcast recommendation. All the Right Movies is a film podcast that, in bringing fresh, insightful perspectives to both classic and contemporary cinema, manages to tell the story of Hollywood one movie at a time. Each episode is a deep dive into a classic film where hosts John, Luke, Westy, and Matt tell the creative story of how the film was made while also analyzing the craft and artistry that makes it significant, all while having a laugh or two along the way. What makes All the Right Movies special, beyond their ability to make every film feel worth discussing, is their incredible community of passionate film fans. They've grown to 35,000 monthly downloads and have over 1.5 million social media followers because they treat their audience like fellow movie enthusiasts with intelligence. With over 1,000 Patreon supporters, they built the kind of engaged community that every podcaster dreams of. Plus, they have a book coming out in 2026, so you know they're serious about their craft. Find All the Right Movies wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and join their community of movie lovers who never run out of great films to discuss. You know, I think we should get the second song out here. We're talking about reflecting over time. Been So Long from River of Time, 2009. Obviously, it's the title of your autobiography. It is one of the songs that you put at the end of that. It's an important song to you. Can you say a little about where you're at with this before we hear it?
Sure. So that was one of the early songs that I wrote. The first recorded version is a live version on Pull Up, Pull Down, Hot Tuna Record. I remember back in that time, Santana, The Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Hot Tuna, we were all recording at Wally Hyder's in San Francisco. And I'll bet you Greg Raleigh wouldn't even remember this. But Greg was fooling around on an organ. He played a chord change. And he just messing around. And I listened to those things and I went, play that slowly for me. Let me listen to it. And anyway, make a long story somewhat shorter. Those became the opening chords that Been So Long. Yeah, I figured out how to do it on the guitar and then I turned it into a song, added some more chords and turned it into a song. I remember I was talking to one of my friends talking about writers that are tortured artists. I'm not a tortured artist, but I do like to go down the emotional rabbit hole from time to time, you know, and all of a sudden it's like Been So Long, Side Belonger, ever since I lost my way. Where does that stuff come from? I mean, who knows, you know, but it made a lot of sense to me at the time. And again, the song was written, there's only two versions of the song, was written in one fell swoop. And I remember before I messed around with it before we recorded the live version, I thought about writing another verse or a bridge or something. And I thought, I've said all I have to say. I'm just letting it go.
All right. Well, we're going to hear this more recent version, 2009, two guitars, mandolin and bass, a little more arranged than the other one in terms of the Mando song. There are lines that are one is descending, one is ascending, a little more interaction seemed a little more, I guess. So just because this song had been in your world so long that you were.
I do it pretty much the same way all the time. But one of the things I enjoy about playing with other people, and I guarantee that we didn't set out to arrange it and say, well, Barry, you do this, or Jack, you do whatever, you know. In my perfect world, the people that I play with are going to bring something to the table that I couldn't have thought about. And they're going to inspire me to make some changes also. So to me, the whole is always greater than the sum of the parts. And Barry, God bless him, has always came up with really cool stuff.
Been so long since I belong here, ever since I lost my way. That was when I still had something special left for me to say unto you. Just to see you smile, you laugh and look at me. And it's been so long since I felt at home in the mirror. Was a time I once came running down the street we used to live. That was when I still had something special left for me to give unto you. Just to see you smile, laugh and look at me. Well, when you Held me tight in the morning, child, now. Well, it's been so long since I felt at home in the mirror.
I'm usually very much on the lookout for when there's an old version and a new version so I can compare them. But I was so focused on, all right, I want something from the last few original albums and this song I was really attracted to in that form. So even though I listened through the Hot Tuna stuff, I did not notice this on there. So I'm just going on the recent one, but it's great that this got to get road tested for so long. So I guess some of these, the sort of Jethro Tull little fast parts, the bridge has quite a lot to it. It sounds like this is maybe something that you might have done in the 70s. There probably aren't too many songs now that have that kind of weirdness to the structure.
Totally agreed. And I wouldn't be able to write a song like that today. Been So Long is an interesting example. There's the two verses, three actually, because the intro is playing the verse, but the two sung verses. Then there's a couple of different sections. Now, I do a lot of guitar teaching, and obviously I teach songs that I play that people want to learn, and that tends to be one of them. And they go, how did you come up with these second parts, however you want to break up the song, the parts after the verse section? And the answer is, at this point in my life, I haven't the slightest idea. But I suspect that those intervals, there's a lot of double stop stuff and whatnot. The intervals that I'm playing, it was probably new-ish, at the very least new-ish to me, and maybe even new at the time. And it just required that, because that was exciting to me, I made sure that I put it into something, and there it is, and now it's a song.
Well, I noticed, yeah, in this and also the other Hot Tuna song that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, there's a lot of articulation in terms of what's going to be downbeat and upbeat, which I have my own notation when I write chord sheets is, well, if it's an onbeat, then it's normal. If it's an upbeat, then it's in italics. So I can just tell the other guitarist or the drummer or whatever, like, okay, we have to go da 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 da. We can't go da 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 da. You know, we have to, and there's a lot of that throughout here that, you know, that you've got your ever since I lost my way, this offbeat articulation.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. And I think that's a function of being a fingerstyle guitar player, such as myself, in which notes played by the thumb are more likely than not to be downbeats. And accents played with your fingers can also be downbeats, depending on how the melody goes, but tend, especially if you're doing something rhythmic, or if I'm doing something, tend to be upbeats. Now, obviously, you know, I'm not parsing the music while I go along while I do this, but it's fun to talk about afterwards. And not everybody gets this, but it's just that if the music devolves into the things where the driving rhythm is played with my fingers, there it's going to be stuff coming on the and, you know, which is not as ballsy as when it's on the one. as G. Smith would say.
I mean, if you hit it hard enough, it's pretty ballsy. Ta, ta,
ta, ta, ta. No, you're right. I mean, again, I'm not sure that we have a solution to this conversation, because I think it depends on how it serves the music also. I think that for me, the magic of fingerstyle guitar playing, because, working in the studio with a guy like Larry, who he has one of these multidimensional minds where he can actually hear the finished product the way he likes it when you start into it, which is great for him, but it's not as much fun for me, because I like things to evolve on their own. And as a fingerstyle guitar player, you're right. Sometimes those upbeat accents are just absolutely as ballsy and as important as a downbeat. And I guess it just depends on the song and how it's used.
Sure.
We're getting out of outer space here. I'm not sure everybody's going to grok this, but...
Another reason I'm glad to hear that this is actually an older tune is because the chorus... Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It actually... I found myself... An important song when I was 11 listening to the radio was Brian Adams, "Gonna Run to You." He was stealing from you. I mean, of course, it's just a two chord progression. It's not anything copyrightable, but that this was actually before that. "Unto You." So I was thinking, okay, this is, you're not producing a lot of original songs at this point, and this was a song about how, yeah, I used to have things to say and now I don't, which I've written songs like that about writers block about something, but then the "Unto You," oh, maybe this is not about not being able to write lyrics, but it's about not having anything to say to your significant other. Which was it, both of those? What do you remember even what this song was about exactly?
Well, the simple answer is going to be no.
Okay.
I think it speaks for itself, and I probably wouldn't write a song like that today, but again, I'm a guitar player that occasionally write songs, not a songwriter who also plays the guitar. So towards the end of COVID, I wrote this song that was inspired by my then younger teenage daughter, impatient with life. And I wrote this little song called "Take Your Time." It's a pretty lyrical song. And the accompaniment to it is very sparse. It's just some chord arpeggiation, And I'm playing it with my fingers, so I guess technically it's a fingerpick song, but it's not, you know what I mean? It's just a rhythmic little song. And I was listening to a version that we recorded earlier the other day that was so good that when we ever get around to finishing up a live album, I'm going to put it on it and use the version of the basic that I recorded back in COVID. But it's just like, it's about telling the story to me also. Mm-hmm. I don't want the guitar, whatever the guitar parts are, to take away from the telling of the story. As somebody was asking me at a workshop we were doing here in Athens a couple months ago, how do you rate yourself as a guitar player? And I said, I rate myself as an intermediate level guitar player with a lot of experience. There's nothing that I do that I couldn't teach anybody to do if they wanted to take the time to learn it, But I think I've developed a solid ability to tell the stories that I want to tell. Now, corollary to that is that I've been playing with my buddy John Hurlbut. It's one of my friends that I've, for years, and we've worked together at the ranch, Furpy Trantalot, blah, blah, blah. And during COVID, we started doing some stuff together. We cut a couple albums. I'm getting ready to go on the road again. And every now and then, I cut him in to play with me at the end of each set, because I can abdicate from being center stage, from having to be Yorma, and just to do another part of my musical life that I love so much, which is just to be an accompanist, where I'm helping somebody else tell the story. And hopefully, in the case what I do with John, or what I did with Jefferson Airplane, where I've got a band or a person that's running the subways, and I get to to dance around through the dining car. Wow, what a metaphor.
There's a second guitar on this. Was that you overdubbing yourself, or was that John or somebody else?
I think that's Larry, and I think he's playing some weird-ass thing like a Saturn or something like that. I think it's Larry.
Oh, okay. Well, let me play just a little bit from the bridge. So let's just take that part initially. I mean, that we're going to sit on this thing, and it's sort of like the mandolin is driving it. Any thoughts about that particular part of that arrangement coming together? Is it just, again, that you have your part and you're letting them do whatever they want? This sounds a little more chord.
That's pretty much the sum total of it, but it's a good build. And if we were to discuss, where did I come up with that? And the answer is, well, there's that double stop thing, and it's probably new to me at the time, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But it's a nice build, and it's melodic enough to a guy who has really solid melodic sensibilities like Barry and Larry can do all kinds of cool stuff. I mean, to re-record that song. I remember Larry goes, why would you want to re-record this song again? And my thing was, because I want to hear what you guys will do with it.
So we got our big rock part.
Yeah, we do. That's all right. That's
which is exactly those offbeat, bam, 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 you know, as powerful as it can get on the acoustics.
Yeah, right. I got it. I can hear the yeah, the drummer's got like 10 toms. You know, one's as big as a bass drum, one's as little as a pencil or something like that. I can hear it all now. That's an A chord there, and it's just a solid build. I'm listening to it, what you're playing there, a little bombastic, I'll admit, but it's a nice build, and it builds up, and then there's that little feel of music.
Some really nice interaction. I mean, the bass is really soaring. One of the guitars is kind of soaring above as you're playing through.
And what's not to like about parallel thirds? I mean, really, you know?
Yeah, those beautiful open, those things that write themselves on guitar.
No, you're right. You're absolutely. And this again, the guitar in standard tuning telling us what we can do. So those are like little two-note suspensions on the third and the fourth string, and it's leaving all the other strings open. And because we're playing in the key we're playing in, it works.
And then we have the Jethro Tull part. Yeah, the fact that happens four times, that
I love, first of all, you noticed, I like doing things in fours. You know, when they're builds, it's going to be fours or maybe eights. So diddly 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 doom bap da 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 da. Okay, so on the guitar, that little lick, the diddly diddly did, that little lick that we're obsessing about here. Mm-hmm. Second fret, fourth string, pull off. Second fret, fifth string, pull off. Third fret, sixth string, and rolling back and forth around that. Again, once again, thank you, guitar and standard tuning.
So basically, bringing back the melodic elements, but we're going to do little... It sounds very Renaissance, these little changes in...
Yeah, I listen to a lot of classical, chamber music when I was a kid, so I don't doubt that it's not conscious, so I can't say, well, I was inspired by Vivaldi. It's not like that. But this might have there. So the chords, E, E minor, G, C, C, D, B minor, and then it's going to wind up in an A. And then it repeats it again, but this time it's going to wind up in an E major, and the E major chord... is first string, second string open, fourth fret of the third string, which is the same note as the second string, with your third finger, and your first finger covers the second fret of strings four and five, open sixth string. So if I'm not mistaken, there's only first and fifths in that chord. So it's a nice modal chord.
Sure. So I will link folks to the original version of that. They can hear that. But we want to hear something from that era. Sleep Song by Hot Tuna from America's Choice 1975 was the one that I picked out. Jack Cassidy still on bass. Bob Steeler on some very hyperactive drums.
Hyperactive, well said.
A lot of very crazy fills in here. Yeah, can you say a little about where you were at with this? Well into the, this is not your first electric foray with Hot Tuna here that you'd sort of, but it may be the some sort of height, some sort of, you know, something you'd been working toward.
Okay, so a song like Sleep Song, that's a drop D song, capo two. So it's an E for Jack. God bless him. Bob is still playing with a bunch of guys out up there in the New York area, and he's still hyperactive. God bless him. But yeah, so that started out as an acoustic song. So one of the things that was really cool about what we were all able to do in that time is to take a song that was basically written on the acoustic guitar, which is where I perform it mostly today, and bring it into a studio where I'm now going to play it on a Stratocaster with heavy gauge strings. Well, I'd be hard pressed to tell you what amp it was. It was probably either an Orange, a Highwater, or a Marshall. I can't remember, but some big, you know, quad four, quad 12 amp, stuff like that. Playing at the volumes that you play that kind of stuff at. And Steeler, that had this huge set of drums and Jack with all that stuff and recording it at extremely loud volumes. Now, I was talking to some folks that are like fans of our music that are younger than me, but they're not kids. And they talk about, boy, I really wish I could hear it like I heard it back at the Academy of Music and whatever year that was, you know. And I go, you will never hear a show like that again. Because in that era, the only thing that was in the PA really was vocals and drums. And all those amplifiers weren't just like swinging dick things because we were men and we needed all those amplifiers. They were actually the source of the sound, you know. And it's going to be a different way to listen to music, and that's just how it is. So Hot Tuna had, as you know, had a potential to be extremely bombastic at times, even with songs that weren't inherently bombastic, like Sleep Song, for example. And for me, listening to either a live version for that period or the studio version, I went, wow, that's not something I would ever have thought about today. It's kind of cool in retrospect, because here's basically a pretty folky kind of thing on a guitar in drop D. And now we've transliterated it into this hypersonic sort of hyperactive thyroid kind of music.
Yesterday, had to meet a place somewhere.
And this is one that I did reflect on. I was listening to one of the live versions. It was from 2018 at the Paramount Theater in April. Anyway, it's one of the many, I'll link folks to the, but like the fact that that da, 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 is in the acoustic part, right?
Yeah.
Even at this point, it's in the, well, the rhythm guitar part, but that lead completely just obliterates. You can't hear what this really nice guitar is doing because you've got the piercing thing.
But before we go any further, in my defense, it was the 70s.
Oh.
But no, I totally agree with you. And again, if I was doing, it's like, I don't know, who knows what I was chasing. I mean, of course, it's really fun to overdub that kind of stuff. And you got the amp. We had the amps in the hallway at Wally Hyder, and it's like 4 a.m. We're the only people there. The whole building is rocking with the sound. I mean, you know, that's something that's probably not going to happen again. But to get back to what I think you were saying was the original stands beautifully on its own and doesn't need all that stuff.
Well, and it's fun that there's a lengthy guitar solo, but you sort of interrupt it for the original guitar to play. The most fun part of the song, or at least of the solo, is not your streaking solo guitar, because you couldn't even do that riff with that, you know.
No, you're right. You're right. So I mean, again, it's like that's part of the original writing of the song. It's a little, very typically folk. God help me for saying this. It's almost like Peter, Paul, and Mary in a way. Yeah, it's a little folky finger-picking thing. But for some silly reason, I'm a genius. No, it just works.
There's that yearning that you get out of this kind of electric playing, this Clapton-esque sort of reaching for the stars kind of thing. I mean, is that something you miss? Like, I haven't noticed in the Hot Tuna that, oh, I'm playing acoustic, but let me hit the pedal and do a little solo. It seems like, no, that's a different universe.
That's a really good point, actually, because, you know, of course, all of us acoustic players, we're always plugged into something, because that's how it works these days. And most of these somethings have a boost pedal, or you can put a boost pedal on. And I've got all that stuff, too. But I'll tell you, I've elected, and when we rehearsed, I've tried it out. It breaks the emotional flow for me, as much as I love doing that kind of stuff. That's why I like doing the stuff I'm doing with John Hurlbut when we play together, where I just get to play lead. And he sings. That gets that out of my system. But with the songs of my own and Hot Tuna and stuff like that, when we tried to recreate the three-man orchestra, the two-man, whatever, by using pedals and stuff like that, it's just not me. Now, I've heard a lot of people. I've heard a lot of really good guitar players that very artfully use looping pedals and all this kind of stuff. And my hat's off to them. At this point in my life, I just have no interest in doing it. I just kind of love dancing in the moment. And usually the moment requires that I not do that. But there's always tomorrow. I'm not closing the door on anything.
Well, I did really like Jack's distorted bass sound on this song. Although on the live version, he really gets to soar and play with you in a much more noticeable, at least, way, because there's just two of you. Yes, we haven't taken time out to praise Jack's playing. So let's
well, let's do it now. Jack and I have been playing together since before Rocks and Water. We first played together in 1958. I've known Jack we've been friends for a really, really long time, and we play together all the time. He is the most inventive musician I think I have ever played with. He comes up with new stuff. I mean, not that he wanders from arrangements and stuff like that. But when the time comes from him to take a solo, he's very adventuresome. You never know what he's going to do. When he's playing an instrument like that Gil Starfire bass of his, where he can play, I don't know how many frets that instrument has, where he can play all over the neck, it's unbelievable. When he's playing one of those acoustic Rebecca basses that he plays, the upper frets are not quite as accessible, but it's still... He's just a really adventuresome guy.
Well, because he was a lead player to start with, and that he became, McCartney referred to as like a bassist who's really a guitar player, but was sort of relegated at some point to playing bass and took him back some advantage of that.
Yeah. I think Jack at this point would take issue with that, but I agree with that statement in a lot of ways. But one thing about the fact of Jack's playing is that he never loses, even though he is a very, very melodic bass player. Think Scotty LaFaro if you're thinking about jazz guys, but he never loses the groove ever. he's rock solid. Now, one of the reasons of this, too, is before Jack came out to California and played the Jefferson Airplane, the last time he and I played together, which would have been in the late 50s, he played in club bands in D.C. for years, rhythm and blues bands, where if he'd screwed around like that, he would have gotten fired. You know, when you're playing a band with four saxophones and all this stuff, you got it out of your bass player. You got work to do. And he knows how to do that work. But because of his lyrical sensibilities, he can do a lot more than that work.
Well, and I know I have to just throw in that you mentioned briefly playing with Jaco Pastorius as just in terms of aggressive lead bass players. So there's nothing recorded of the U2, right?
There might be somewhere, but I don't have it. I would be interested in hearing that myself. So, yeah, poor Jaco, may he rest in peace. Man, what an interesting guy. And the other thing was that I remember Jaco, we didn't play together for very long, but we did a couple of little tours together and a bunch of stuff. I remember we're sitting around backstage, and I'm finger-picking something on an acoustic guitar. And there's another guitar, and he picks it up. It was probably some, I don't remember what it was, but some finger-picking piece. And he goes, how do you do that? So I show him, and he does it immediately.
On bass or on guitar?
No, on the guitar. Okay. He picks up the guitar, and he finger-picks the song. I'm going, I want to say it took me years to learn how to do that. And then he put the guitar down, and then that moment was gone. I mean, what an interesting guy.
All right. Well, I violated my general interview rule, which is, what was it like to work with that famous person? I try not to do that because you probably get that enough. Back to Sleep Song. Yeah. Things kind of settle down after each verse that you throw in sort of an extra 8 count of this. Is it a 12 string? I wrote harpsichord guitar. See if this sounds.
Let's have a listen. I'll tell you.
I mean, it has the effect of that McGuinn 12-string sort of feel. But
yeah, it's not a 12-string. It's a Fender Strat with heavy gauge strings on it. I'm guessing there's a studio, just from the sound of it. It's a lifetime ago. I can't remember.
Sure.
Mallory Earl, the guy that produced that record, he might have had me double the guitar. Now, today we do with a gadget of some sort, but I might have played that. It might be a double there.
It wasn't entirely clear to me. When you're playing electric, are you still playing with a flat pick, or are you always playing with your fingers?
Like when I'm doing the leads, I'm playing with a flat pick.
Okay. But probably that probably was you just doing your finger picking style.
Those are fingers, definitely.
Just to mention, the offbeats are even much more prominent in this one. Wonder why we feel this way. And then blowing across the water, ship with us down. You know, that you've got this very... So again, are these sort of choreographed? How are you... Even at that point, was it just... Let the drummer just listen to what you're doing, or are you giving actually the directions to the drummer because you have to?
No, he's a Steeler's just he's just playing to what he listens to.
Okay,
because that basic guitar part is a finger style guitar part, and because my fingers, I have the metal finger picks on the two fingers, you can really hear those accents a lot. So let's move into the present for a moment. So I started playing with Justin Gwip, who's been our drummer for a number of years, and he listened to these old recordings. And he's asked me questions that sounded like what you were just talking about. Do you want me to play this accent? Do you want to play that? And what I had to tell him was, just the simple answer is, I'm not a drummer and I don't know. I would encourage you to play what you hear and what feels comfortable for you to play. I mean, I would never want to script something for somebody that they don't like to play. And he listened to it and he got what was necessary. So the other thing is that because the fingers, again, tend to be on upbeats, I don't want the rhythm to completely devolve into a thing where it's
Yeah, sure. Let me play some of the bridge.
Winter wind keeps blowing through the trees, but life keeps breathing gaily as you please. It's not silver birches lying.
So you're even doing the chat, chat, where you're playing on the snare. The effect is this one guitar less.
It would really be fun if we had Bob Steeler in this conversation too, because he could really tell you. I mean, who knows how he conceived of these things? And the answer is not me, but I like what he did.
Any thoughts about just, I mean, I know it's a long time since you wrote these lyrics, but like they're pretty straightforwardly emotional. And you describe in the book how many of the songs in this period are sort of about a marriage that lacked communication or much intimacy, or just, you know, something that should have been put out of its misery probably earlier.
True.
then we're going, oh, now we're talking about the winter wind. Now we're talking about silver birches lying by the, we're doing this pastoral imagery. How do you connect the personal stuff with the nature stuff?
I was in Sweden about living above the Arctic Circle when I wrote the song, and that's the way things looked. There's a lot of birch trees up there. I mean, it was inspired by just literally what I saw in front of me. I mean, obviously, if I was sitting down here in Southeast Ohio, where I live now, surrounded by hardwood and pines, I wouldn't even known about silver birches, you know?
I think that's the best reason to write nature lyrics is if it's the nature that's in front of you. If it's just space-filling cliche or something.
For me, it would be the only way. Otherwise, how do you know what it looks like?
Sure, sure. I mean, I guess, so you describe in the book how this was called Sleep Song, right? Because you had to write it at a low volume because of the situation you were in. Like, why would that idea carry over to the song itself, which has nothing to do, like, the In My Dreams could have been called the Sleep Song, but why is that title stick around for this?
I don't want to go out on the limb too far here, but I remember that when we would go, I lived in California at the time. So when we would go over to, we were doing that speed skating thing there for a while. And when this song was written, I was living in this province of North Sweden. There's like an 8-hour difference from California to Central Europe at that time. And so when I got there, my sleep schedule was so turned around, but I couldn't sleep when I was supposed to sleep. And so I guarantee that this song was probably written at night. Just I'm sitting up and I can't sleep and I got to do something.
All right, let me ask you a slightly challenging question to wrap us up here. Just reflecting on the newer versions of this and some of the other songs, like I really like this melody, go across the water, ship without a sail. Like this sticks in my brain, but it seems like when you sing this now live, go across the water, ship without a sail, like you just sort of Bob Dylan it. You're talk singing more that it's more about the guitar is keeping the melody and playing the nice, you know, on pitch things. And the voice is sort of narrating and talking you through it. And you just thought about that overall. Did you not like this melody so much? Like for me, if the melody is the thing, is the song, then it has to stay. Like you have to sing. But that seems like a sort of throughout your catalog.
You know what I think happens? You know, I think being in the game for and doing it for songs as long, I think one has a tendency. One, you can substitute I for that, has a tendency to get lazy sometimes. And it's worth thinking about because sometimes in the evolution or the de-evolution of songs and performance is not necessarily a good thing. And I think that, again, somebody that's been doing this for as long as I have, and the songs that I choose to keep or resuscitate in a repertoire are songs that I still love, otherwise I wouldn't play them. And sometimes I think I just get lazy, honestly. I think that's what it is.
Well, I could also see if it's sort of a catchy tune like that of kind of getting sick of it over time. That I know even with my songs that there was a period where I would be rehearsing in the house and my wife would say, like, you're not even singing the melody anymore. Like you're doing that. I just, you know, that you have this sort of jazz brain and it just wants to vary things and until you're not even singing.
Yeah. It sounds like your wife knows my wife, by the way. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think, I mean, so then you know what I'm talking about. I mean, why would we do that? Are we getting lazy? Are we reaching for something else? If you've got a song that you're playing, letting it mutate in the moment may not be a good thing. I'm aware of this sometimes too. It's like, man, I wish I don't know. I've got to go back to basics here. And I was just thinking about it the other day. I'm a better singer than I was when I was younger. I don't have an acrobatic voice. But my teenage daughter is an unbelievable singer, and she has that acrobatic voice. But that's not me. I'm just like Crosby said, Yorma, you're a storyteller. Relax. But every now and then I find myself maybe obfuscating the notes a little bit or adding to it. And I honestly, if I listen to a recorded version, I never like it as much as I did the original.
So to close out here, your press release said we are pushing right now, even though this is a podcast about original songwriting, but so much of what you do are these classics, are these Depression era songs, these Reverend Gary Davis or his interpretations. So Reno Road, unreleased tracks from the 60s, which for some reason, none of the websites about it actually say, even though you know you were on your way, you stopped at Jack's house when you're on your way back to the Philippines to see your parents, but they can't seem to identify exactly what year. So 61, 62, something.
That's 1960.
Oh, no, okay. 19. All right. That's better than was reported online. Okay. So I picked Hesitation Blues, one of the songs that you often sing now, and I will direct people to the recent version. But this is, talk about going back to basics. this is you at age 20 then, right? You know, in sort of the original iteration, your original take on this song. I assume you listened back through this record before they released it?
Do you even know? Well, I mean, yeah, that's how we rediscovered it. But I hadn't listened to it for over half a century.
Sure.
I listened to it back when we did it.
Do you recall even, you know, being surprised by some of the melodies that you were singing, which were probably just straight off the record in the way that maybe they've morphed in?
One of the things that surprised me when I listened to this stuff, because keep in mind, I'd only been finger picking for 4 months when we recorded that stuff.
Wow.
And I think the first thing I did when I listened to it is, wow, for a novice finger picker, I wasn't bad. I mean, it's dangerous to say shit like that because it sounds like you're patting yourself on the back too much, but I already had a pretty firm grasp of where I needed to go. And the other thing is, because I'm so close to the source there, the versions are so much purer than when they became more me later on, which is not a criticism, just the way it was.
Yeah, certainly the guitar is more interesting on the recent versions, but yeah, there's just a definite charm to these old things. So yes, that's what we're going to leave folks with. Hesitation Blues, originally by W.C. Handy, but this is a Reverend Gary Davis interpretation, is that?
Reverend Gary Davis transliterated through Ian Buchanan, who taught me how to play the cymbal.
Gotcha. Well, thanks so much for doing this.
Well, listen, thanks for great questions. Great talking to you. It's really fun to talk to another musician because we know what we're talking about when we do this. So that's a lot of fun.
All right. Here it is. Hesitation Blues. Wow, I am so grateful for the chance to talk to Jorma, and I really wasn't familiar with much of his output before prepping for this. I had wanted to do a Jefferson Airplane-related episode at some point, but most of the members have passed away. I knew that a couple of guys had gone off and done Hot Tuna while the rest of the band became Jefferson Starship. And given how cheesy some of Jefferson Starship's music is, I was thinking that maybe this was the artistically adventurous part of Jefferson Airplane. But I certainly didn't know about Yorma's fascination with the Reverend Gary Davis, such that a good chunk of his output, whether through Hot Tuna or solo, is these cover tunes like Hesitation Blues, evincing a real fascination with and respect for these Depression-era songs. I should mention that his 2002 Blue Country Heart album was nominated for a Grammy. That is nearly all country blues cover songs. So this was a really interesting guy to approach, given my particular interest in songwriting. And I'll admit, it saved me a little time that I didn't have to listen to every single song on all of his old albums. I just went right to the originals. But it's all worth your time, and you can learn more about him at jormakaukonen.com. And I highly recommend that autobiography, Been So Long, My Life in Music. You can listen to him read it on Spotify or Audible or other places. I've linked to a number of live versions, old video, some really great songs that we did not cover on this podcast from the blog post corresponding to this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or there's also a version at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. That will get you the ad-free version with a link to my episode notes with the lyrics and structures all laid out there. So I'd really appreciate your support. Again, that's patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Even the smallest per episode donation will get you those extras and will let me know that you want this podcast to continue. If you are listening to this on a public feed, you'll hear our first host read ad in a while. For some reason, the whole industry for that had gone down, and I haven't had ads on most of my non-partially examined life podcasts that I read for quite a while. So it's just these auto insert ads, which of course there's still some of on this. But because we have some more host read ad business in the works, I think this podcast will be moving back to a more every 2 week release schedule. So we'll see how long I can actually sustain that level of effort. I'd kind of gotten used to putting more time into prepping for an episode like this one with so many albums, such a deep catalog, so much to learn about this person. I've recorded two more episodes since recording this one. First with John Kruth, a multi-instrumentalist who led the New York world music band Tribecistan, and he has many solo albums and has backed the Violent Femmes and other folks. And then I spoke to another New Yorker, the incredible Willie Nile, who has released many, many excellent, often extremely chantable rock and roll songs since 1980. Hope you are doing well, keeping creative. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Litzmeier signing off.